and welcome to Talking Aussie Books, a weekly podcast bringing readers and writers of Australian fiction together. I'm Claudine Tennellis. As an avid reader and passionate advocate for Australian fiction, I make it my mission to spotlight local talent. So if you're looking for your next read or simply want to learn more about the Australian literary scene, this podcast is for you. Grab yourself a cuppa, sit back and relax. This episode is brought to you by Affirm Press. Listeners, I've long subscribed to the theory that our lives are predestined. Fate has a hand in the trajectory of our lives, whether we acknowledge it or not. Every single decision you make and the conscious or unconscious reason for doing so is another step leading you to the exact position you find yourself in today and another move in the universe's giant chess game that is your life. Taking that job, that trip, or even the decision to buy a lottery ticket is the work of fate pushing you in one direction or another. Good, bad, or indifferent, sometimes there's no other way to explain the way our lives pan out. And so any book that explores the role fate plays is always going to be one I will enjoy. Enter Rhianna King and her brilliant debut novel, Birds of a Feather, published at the end of March by Affirm Press. Rhianna is a Melbourne-based author who has spent more than two decades working as a communicator in the public and not-for-profit sectors. During the long lockdowns of 2020 and 2021, Rhianna fancied company of people other than those she was in lockdown with and so decided to create characters with whom to spend time with. The result was Birds of a Feather, an absolutely delightful novel about forbidden romance, second chances, taking yourself beyond your comfort zone, and of course, fate. I laughed, I cried, and I just fell in love with this charming and assured story from a talented newcomer. So welcome to the podcast, Rhianna.
Oh, thank you so much, Claudine. It's such a pleasure to be here, and I'm so rapt with that introduction. Thank you so much. It's beautiful.
Oh, you're so very welcome. Congratulations on such a wonderful novel. As I said to you before we started recording, I kind of find it a little bit hard to fathom that this is your debut. Just incredible.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I mean, I think what COVID provided us was, apart from lots of sourdough baking and opportunities to binge on Netflix, it was an opportunity, not for everybody, but for some people to lean into those things that you'd kind of meant to, they were on your to-do list. I did start writing in that time, and I've been watching lots of Sally Hepworth's Writerly Wednesday tutorial. She did a series during lockdown, and she broke it down in sort of these, really bite-sized pieces for authors to tackle in a way that felt very accessible. And so, it really was just a case of, putting pen to paper and watching it all kind of take shape. And because I had the time available, because, during those dark lockdown days of, 23 hours spent inside, it was a chance to just give it a crack. And I've just been so grateful that it's taken flight, with pardon the pun, and now it's out there in the world. So yeah, it's been an exciting ride.
Indeed. And I wondered, when learning about you and about this book and how you came to write it, if writing was something you'd always dreamed of doing, or was it more of a knee-jerk reaction to COVID?
I think, I've worked in comms for, my whole career. So I've always written, but the writing that I've done has been, for other people. So whether it's, writing the words of people would deliver in speeches, or whether writing media releases or social posts or, reports and things like that. And I suppose this was the first time that I gave myself permission to write in my voice rather than on behalf of somebody else or on behalf of other subject matter. So it was probably a natural progression from a, from a writing comms perspective, but it was, certainly the first time that I'd really allowed myself the space and time and confidence to kind of give it a crack from my own perspective and tell a story from my heart rather than from a bureaucracy.
As I alluded to in my introduction, Birds of a Feather was such a thoroughly enjoyable read. It was pacey, it was never dull, and layered with so much rich detail and exploration of various themes. Rhianna, you essentially created a world I didn't want to leave. So I wanted to ask you, where did you draw your inspiration from? Who or what compelled you to start writing this particular story?
Sure. So as you said, there are quite a few themes, but I guess one of the things I was most keen to explore is really the relationship between the main character, Beth, and her grandmother, who's an 82-year-old woman who Beth really feels quite disconnected from the rest of her family. She's a very straighty 180. She's very organized and pragmatic and practical and competent and capable and all of the things I probably wish I was a bit more of. And where her family are, creative, artistic, bohemian, flawed but lovable characters. And so Beth kind of has grown up in this very chaotic world that she really doesn't feel like she belongs in. But what she does have is she has an ally in her grandmother, Elise, who is a lover of natural environment, as Beth is, but she's also a pretty remarkable woman. So she was, you know, university educated. She went on to have a long career in the sciences, and the two of them have a really special bond. So I was particularly interested in looking at that dynamic between granddaughters and their grandmothers, because I personally have had an amazing experience with both my maternal and paternal grandmothers. And, you know, I just think grandmothers are there to love you when your own parents don't. You know, I had a really amazing experience of my grandmother lived sort of with us and with a couple of other family members, you know, for a time in my late teens. And, you know, just having that extra energy in the house and having the wisdom that comes with being a mature woman and having the untied love that grandparents can give their grandchildren when they're not having to worry about dropping you off and picking you up and whether you've had lunch and, you know, who you're hanging out with on the weekend and things like that. So in the case of my grandmother, so my own maternal grandmother was university educated. She did a psychology degree in the late 40s, which, you know, was pretty remarkable at that time. She would have been one of only a few women who were studying that at the time. She then went on to work as an industrial psychologist. So even that is quite unique. She was a real champion for women in sort of factory settings and industrial settings. So that was really special. And then went on to work as a child welfare psychologist. So she, you know, had a long career in that space. But in the middle of all that, she also raised a family of five children, and she, you know, was a really great neighbor and friend and daughter and, you know, all the things that women tend to carry all these hats of. And my paternal grandma, she really advocated for her own education. Her parents were farming. They didn't think they could afford a boarding school education. She really pushed for that because she wanted to become a teacher herself. And she ended up becoming a teacher, but then met my grandfather in the town that she was posted to. So unfortunately, that marked the end of her teaching career. But, you know, she was always really involved in civic duties. And, you know, she was actually the first JP of their local town, only by a minute, because it just so happened that her name fell in the alphabet earlier than the other woman who was being signed in. But that's a, you know, a detail of history that we can probably skip over for the sake of a good yarn. But anyway, both these women were also really prolific writers in their own right. So it was really magic to kind of channel them and really think about how they would have seen the world and, you know, how they would have seen this writing experience. So, yeah.
I love that so much. That relationship, the grandparent-grandchild relationship, was something that I was so interested in, because it's something that I write about in my own work, and also driven by the fact that my children share such a wonderful bond with their own grandparents. I loved the two of them so much, and I think you gave them such colour and character. It was, yeah, just a joy to read about. Anyway, stopping my gushing right there. I wondered, Rhianna, for the benefit of those listeners who've yet to discover your gorgeous novel, if you could tell us a little bit more about the story.
So without giving too many spoilers away, so as I said, you know, Beth comes from this rambunctious family. They have these Saturday lunches each week. Usually they're a disaster. Always they're populated by some themed lunch or costume event, because that's the type of people that they are. And then at one particular lunch, they are having a discussion around the fact that NASA has found a 13th star sign. And this is actually true. So there's a story around it. I won't spoil it. People can go and research it themselves, but there are actually 13 star signs. But what that meant for the book and for the story is that it's an opportunity to question, what if our star signs changed and the little pieces of the zodiac that we find ourselves sitting in were recalibrated, then me as a Sagittarius and all of the Sagittarian traits that I have to then become a different star sign actually would really throw me. And so anyway, the family are having this, you know, very robust discussion over a lunch one day, and Beth and her sister Jara, who looks for the meaning of life in, you know, ruins and tea leaves and, you know, the whispers of the wind, really challenges Beth about, you know, the fact that she doesn't ever throw caution to the wind. She accuses her of being too uptight. She questions, you know, whether she's ever really just handed her life over to fate to kind of make a few decisions. And so I think it's a couple of days later, Beth then, you know, says, I'll prove I can be spontaneous and I'll buy a lotto ticket. And then as luck would have it, she actually wins. And she wins an amount, you know, about $200,000, which is sort of I think she describes it as life altering rather than life changing. So it's sort of that amount of money that you would, it would really make a difference to your life, but it's not going to change the way you live, I guess. So I was keen to find that sort of sweet spot of money where, you know, you could really make some big differences in your life, but not completely, you know, you're not going to go and live in the Bahamas for the rest of your life. So anyway, and then when she's working out how she's going to divvy up the money, she asks her gran what she would like to, you know, how she can repay some of the kindness and how she can share some of this gift with her. And her gran tells her that she's wondered what had happened to her first love, Jerry. Anyway, as we learn in the book, we find out that Jerry's actually a woman. And so their relationship was thwarted by the conservatism of the time, back in the 19 sort of 40s, 50s, where a queer relationship between two women would not have been something that you could, you know, easily pursue without, you know, judgment and potentially prosecution in some places. So they connect with Jerry, and then what happens afterwards is just this sort of tumble of synchronicity and fate and chance meetings, and just really allowing these two characters who are, you know, incredibly definite in how they think, just the opportunity to give in a little bit to the universe and kind of see what happens. And yeah, there's a few twists and turns along the way that I guess for me as a writer, and I hope for the readers, you know, just helps you keep in perspective that, you know, life is potentially predetermined, and you know, we think we can put all the plans in place in the world, but you know, ultimately we actually don't have control over a lot of things. And some things you look back on and you think, you know, oh right, okay, that's why that happened, even if it wasn't sort of apparent at the time. So
Yeah, indeed. Just a marvelous, marvelous story. Yeah, I was so fascinated by Elise as a character. I mean, I love the fact that the story was from the point of view of Beth and Elise. We talked about this incredible relationship that they had. Yet, despite the closeness of this relationship, Elise had hidden a huge part of her life from, you know, not only from Beth, but her entire family. And this intimate relationship that she had with Jerry back when she was at university studying botany was not something Beth nor her family had ever known about, and came as something of a shock, you could say. But the 1950s, as you alluded to, wasn't a time of sexual freedom. And I think it may be hard for some listeners to understand the kind of stigma and conservatism of that era. Something that I think you explore so poignantly in Elise's narrative. And I'm sure I'm not alone in hearing so many stories of women and men coming out later in life as society has changed, much to the surprise of their husbands, wives, or families, and often at the expense of having denied a huge part of themselves for many, many years. So I wanted to ask you, Rhianna, can you tell us a little bit more about this and why this was something you wanted to write about?
Yeah, I should preface it just by saying that, you know, I'm not a member of the LGBTQI community, so I'm very respectful that the story that I tell of Elise is one of, you know, a fictional character, and the way that I talk about her in the book and her experiences obviously is not everybody's experience, and I wouldn't want to speak on behalf of that community because, you know, I'm not part of that community. But one of the things that I was keen to explore was, you know, when you have older people who have, you know, perhaps there's a part of themselves that they have kept repressed. You know, I think there's a line in there where we talk about it's a new set of visa conditions that people have got in a whole new world, you know, where having a same-sex relationship in the 1950s, in some cases, particularly for males, would have actually been illegal. And, you know, there were certainly cases of sting operations. There was a whole campaign, if you like, against homosexuality. And while women were treated slightly different from men, a lot of times women being lesbians was actually considered an illness or a mental illness. There was a lot of intolerance towards same-sex relationships in, you know, in the 1950s. And so how would that be for a person who's repressed those feelings about themselves to then emerge in this new world where there's a whole amount of acceptance for people? And, you know, we're so conditioned, I think, sometimes by our lived experiences that the bravery, you know, it would take then to come out and own that part of yourself after keeping it secret for such a long time. And, you know, I think even when Elise and Jerry get together when they're back at university, you know, what I hope to convey is I don't even think Elise understood what was happening. You know, it was, she didn't even have the vocab necessarily to describe the feelings that she was having, you know, those deep, intense feelings that she was having for a woman. And so I was really just keen to tease out some of those themes and explore those themes. I was also really keen to showcase a older love story. There's lots of great you know, TV shows and books and things around at the moment that are celebrating older women being sexual, because I think, you know, they are in many cases, and why shouldn't they be? And it's not something to be squeamish, you know, maybe we can celebrate it. But then, you know, perhaps the way that we talk about those relationships is, you know, slightly different, or, you know, the way we portray them. But I was keen to challenge myself in that way, to sort of think of an 80-year-old woman getting gushy and falling in love again. And, you know,
how did you get inside Elise's head? Because while her feelings for Jerry were straightforward, she did really have ambivalent feelings about the hand that fate had dealt her, wouldn't you say?
I was really keen to capture that older woman with the wisdom that comes with age. But also, I think, you know, I'm in my early to mid 40s and I feel like I'm less wise now than what I was when I was 20. So I feel like there is a wisdom that comes with life experience, but then there's also, you've got so much more baggage and questioning and things. In some ways, that makes you less certain. So I was keen to sort of see how, you know, a woman who has lived this life, she's had a marriage, she wasn't unhappy in her marriage with her husband. So she had a really long and loving marriage with a man. She valued her family. She understood that had she not have led that life, she wouldn't have had her children and then grandchildren. And so what I wanted to show from that was that sometimes, you know, life goes in a particular way, that one thing has to happen in order for another thing to happen. But then that doesn't mean that you can't revisit old opportunities. So the opportunity to reconnect with Jerry was such a blessing for her, because she didn't regret the fact that she didn't run off into the sunset with Jerry, because she understood that all of the intermediary years had to happen in order for that life plan to kind of work out for her. So yeah, it was just teasing out where fate takes us, and, you know, again, just revisiting that one thing has to happen in order for the sequence of events to fall into place that leads us to the place that we didn't perhaps know that we were ever going to end up at.
I don't know about you, but I've often thought about what I would do if I won lotto.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe not so much anymore, but certainly when I was younger and the mortgage was bigger and the kids were smaller. And the answer isn't always straightforward. So I was rather intrigued by the dilemma that Beth faces when she wins around $260,000 that she won. And I was surprised to read about the measures that the lotto office took to, I guess, counsel Beth on how to deal with her winnings. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah, that was really interesting, actually. So sudden wealth syndrome that is mentioned in the book is a very real thing, more so in America. I think they recently had a $1 billion lotto draw in America, which actually just blows my mind. I don't even know how you would even begin to process that amount of money. I don't even think you could sit that amount of numbers into a bank statement, you know, before you'd start falling off. So sudden wealth syndrome is, you know, a real thing that people face when they win a big amount of money. People come out of the woodwork and have business opportunities. There's relatives that you mightn't have seen for ages. And that leads to feelings of guilt and feelings of anxiety. And like, it's a whole thing. And there's, I'm sorry, I don't know the stat off the top of my head, but the number of people who end up bankrupt within, you know, a couple of years of actually winning huge amounts of money is quite staggering. So I was keen to get in there that the lotto services will often offer that kind of counseling, if you like, to people. Beth's $260,000 is probably not enough to warrant, you know, some deep diving welfare checks or anything. But yeah, it's definitely a thing that people deal with. So it's an interesting phenomenon, you know. So many of us spend so much time hoping and willing that we'll win lotto, but then what happens when you actually get it, and what do you do with it? One of the hardest part of the books, and I came back to it so many times, was deliberating the amounts to give to Beth's family. You know, in the book, that's an opportunity to explore her relationship with her sister, Jara, who's very irresponsible, you know, by her standards with money. And because in doing so, I suppose I had to look inside myself of what I thought was fair. So if you win $260,000, what is the fair amount to give your parents, or what's the fair amount to give to your sisters and brothers? And then would you give to, you know, charity? And so it was actually an interesting hypothetical exercise for me to do myself, to actually think about how I would use that money as well. So yeah, I don't know, double-edged sword winning lotto, I think.
I often think that with the benefit of age and a bit of wisdom, a bit of life experience, I think it's probably a bit more of a curse than it is a blessing.
Maybe just a little bit would be
Maybe just a
nice.
little bit. I think you gave birth just enough. Like you said, it wasn't life changing, but it did enable her to be a little bit less careful. She did loosen up a little bit with that money.
And I think because she would always have found an excuse not to do something based on money. And I think that was the other thing. She needed the freedom to be able to be bold without the excuse, the self-imposed excuses that she would normally have put upon herself. But if it had been too much money, then she would have probably just squirreled the whole thing away and,
I love the way you really explored this notion of deserving and undeserving and our notions of who deserves what based on our own values. Because I think all of us do that very same thing. If people don't necessarily have the same values that we do, does that mean that they're less deserving? I don't know.
And again, when with the sudden wealth syndrome, that's one of the things that, in some of the research that I did where they talk about, you can give money to somebody thinking that you might be funding a fresh start for them. Maybe they're struggling with dependency or they're, making, poor life choices. But then you have to face the reality that if you give them money, then that actually could just be funding the very behaviors that you're trying to help them get out of. And, once you gift somebody something, unless you do it in a pretty structured and controlled way, you really do lose control. So it was an interesting experiment and an interesting opportunity to look at that in myself and, really challenge my own values about what you think is, deserving and undeserving. Definitely.
Yeah, so many ethical dilemmas in there. A minefield. There is a beautiful theme in this book around the stunning Gouldian finch. I had no idea that these beautiful birds, native to Western Australia, were endangered, and I knew even less about the origin of its name and the work of John Gould and his artist wife, Elizabeth. Tell me about this, Rhianna, and how it came to be part of this wonderful story.
I was really keen for nature to be kind of a bit of a character in the book. I've, worked in conservation agencies for a lot of my career and, I really have a huge love and affinity of nature. But I also feel like the natural environment is such a leveler for people as well. So where I felt like it was important to introduce the natural environment was to give Beth and her grandmother Elise a real common ground that they could just share, the two of them. So it was something that both interested them academically. They both studied sciences, but then they also spent time in the bush, which I just thought was a really beautiful unifier for them. And then I guess, the book deals with intergenerational relationships and strong women over history. And so I was really keen to introduce another element of having Elizabeth Gould, who was, as you said, married to John Gould, who was a naturalist that came out in the early days of European settlement to survey birds in Australia. She came out with him as his wife, but also she was a prolific artist in her own right. So he would go and find birds and bring them back to her, and she would then illustrate them. So a lot of her illustrations are, even today, are still the pivotal samples of these records. However, completely unsung. So she never received a lot of kudos at the time. She actually passed away a year to the day that they got back from Australia, sadly. So she was really very young, left a young family. And so, whether it was because she passed away young or because she was a woman, but she never really received a lot of celebration for her work. But in the last few years, there's actually been some really amazing books. The Birdman's Wife by Melissa Ashley, who I read probably just before I started the book, but she explores beautifully the life of Elizabeth Gould. And so the relevance of the Gouldian finch as well is that John Gould named the Gouldian finch after his wife Elizabeth because he believed it to be the most beautiful bird in the world. And I just love that idea that, you would be so moved by something in nature that you would want to name it after your beloved partner who you'd lost. So yeah, so and I just felt like that having that sort of historical theme and the connection and the Gouldian finches and the John and Elizabeth Gould story does sort of track through. And it also provides a couple of plot points in the second half of the book when they travel to London, where they have the opportunity to see some of those records and really, learn a bit more about them. So that was a really nice part actually to write and research. And I had the opportunity to go to the Natural History Museum in London while I was there. And the good folks at the library let me have a look at the original book that features in Birds of a Feather. And it was so magic just to see these beautiful illustrations that were done by Elizabeth Gould. And yeah, just pay homage to a really remarkable woman in science who, like so many other female scientists, just never really got the recognition that she deserved at the time. But we're championing her now. We're flying her flag now.
Yeah, it was a really special part of this story. And I did wonder how much of that was based on fact. And I loved that scene where they went to the library in the Natural History Museum. Mm. Yeah, I guess the part of the story that was set in London was probably some of my favourite scenes in the book, because I love London, probably like mm. Beth and probably like you, because it felt
yeah,
like
yeah,
you
yeah.
had walked those streets and done all of those things that Beth and Elise did. I genuinely appreciated all of those lovely little details and all the touristy things and the not so touristy things. Going to Greenwich, for example, I think was,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
just a wonderful, wonderful thing that you put in. There's so much beautiful detail in this book, Rhianna.
I love London. We've been a few times, but actually so we had a family holiday booked. We'd been, you know, planning this really since COVID struck, and then it had sort of been deferred until last year. And it was actually, I found out that Affirm was going to publish this book 2 weeks before we left. So that meant that the structural edit needed to happen while I was away. And for anybody who doesn't know, the structural edit is when the editors really look at sort of, you know, plotting and timing and things like that. And one of the things that I had was to chop about 25,000 words from this manuscript that I submitted. So it was a big job. But what it meant was that a lot of the places that I had on my kind of, you know, travel itinerary then actually became ground truthing. So it was a really, really special time to be in London at that time. I made a trip out to Kensal Green Cemetery, which is also featured in the book. Yeah, we went to the Tower of London and we went to on the London Eye. And yeah, it was really special to actually be able to ground truth it, because while I'd been to London before, a lot of this book was written, you know, with the good services of Google Images and Google Street View and things, because when you live over the other side of the world, you have to rely on this sort of technology. So, yeah.
Honestly, Rhianna, I think I could talk to you all day about the cast of characters in this book and their traits and motivations. I just felt like I got to know them so well. And so, of course, I was utterly devastated by the direction that you took the plot in, not to give away any spoilers, but I totally understand why you did this. But I wanted to ask you, was this always the way that you intended the story to pan out, or was this as much of a surprise to you as it was to the reader?
I had always planned for it because I felt like the series of events that had to happen had to happen. And so it's been, again, not wanting to give spoilers, but I'm enjoying people reading the book and sending me just various emojis, and I know exactly where they're at in the book. I get a lot of how could yous, you know, that sort of thing. But I guess that was looking at fate. You know, you have to sometimes weather the bad in order to get the good. And, you know, maybe these sort of subplots of life have to happen in order for the main story to kind of come through. And so, and also kind of that's life. And also that's life when you're dealing with intergenerational relationships. And we love to think that everybody's going to be around forever, but they're not, unfortunately. Yeah, I was keen to explore that, but I've been challenged about it. People have definitely been questioning, did I really have to do it? But I do feel like it had to happen in order for the story to kind of round out the way that it did. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I totally understand. So, Rhianna, if there was one thing that you would like readers to take away from this novel, what would it be?
You know, I think we can all just really allow ourselves the courage to believe that everything happens in a way that we can't control. And, you know, I think in life now, we just, everything is so scheduled and so controlled. And, you know, when COVID happened, we lost control of our lives. I just remember I didn't feel at home in my own life. It was the first time that I really just didn't feel like I knew from one day to the next what was going to happen. And so there was a surrendering process to that, I guess. It was all of the things that I thought my life were about and all of the things that I did in my life that made me happy and felt fulfilled all of a sudden were just cut off. But then out of that came beauty as well, and, you know, opportunities to do things. Yeah, I hope that it just allows people to feel like maybe they can just be a bit bold. And I also think, you know, the connection between family members and the connection between people. And I hope that it just helps people to realize that, you know, even in families and friendship groups where there's flawed people and there's tricky dynamics and there's difficult relationships, you know, these people are just part of the patchwork of our lives that make it rich. And sometimes you roll your eyes at your family members and sometimes you grit your teeth and bite your tongue, but ultimately they enrich our lives in some way, even if you don't necessarily know where it is, you know, at that time. And I hope that people call their grandmothers and say that I love you, because I would love to be able to do that to mine, but I haven't been able to. So yeah, I just think that relationship is such a treasured one. And if it's right for people, I hope that, yeah, it just helps remind you, you know, that that's such a special bond.
It is indeed so beautifully said. Thank you so much for sharing. Rhianna, I wondered if you're working on something else at the moment.
I am actually. There's a couple of ideas that I've got in the pipeline and one that I've kind of started working on. Yeah, I'm excited about it. So Where Birds of a Feather deals with the idea of fate. The next one I'm interested in looking at guilt. So how we navigate our own guilt, how we accumulate layers of guilt, how we seek penance for our guilt, and how that looks in a young modern woman who, you know, I think we just get so many layers of guilt upon us, and there's lots of different forms of guilt. And I just am excited at looking at that as a notion. So yeah, I'm excited with where that's going. I don't think that we've seen the end of the Dwyer family either, hopefully.
Yeah.
Like, I think there's, you know, potentially spin-offs. I'd like to get to know Jarrah a bit more. I think that's something that I'm excited for the future. So yeah, definitely lots of things going on.
I absolutely would love to see more of the Dwyer family. I particularly want to see what happens to Beth.
I've heard a lot of other authors say this when you finish up the book, like, I really missed them. And, you know, when the story finishes, and I often find myself wondering how Beth would feel about these current events. It's a funny feeling to have got to know these people so intimately and them be such a big part of, you know, your life now, my life now. And I hope they have weaseled their way into readers' hearts. And it's a really interesting journey to take with them. And then what happens to them? I'm not sure. I think that's why, yeah, authors keep going back for sequels, because they're not quite ready to let the characters go.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I also think sometimes readers aren't quite ready to let them go. As I said, I was so invested in the world that you created that I could have just stayed there forever. Rhianna, you might know that there are a lot of writers that listen to this podcast. And so I wondered, given all your experiences to date, if you maybe had a few tips that you could offer aspiring authors out there.
Yeah, sure. I mean, as I said earlier, I listen to Sally Hepworth's Writerly Wednesdays Instagram series. I know Lisa Ireland does little videos as well. Our Australian author community is among the most generous people with their time and expertise that I know. You know, I know that there's so many great courses out there, and I know people get a lot of success from them, and that's amazing. But even if you're just wanting to dip your toe into it, there are so many resources out there that people can access that doesn't have to be a hugely expensive operation. You don't have to have a huge amount of time. It can just be that you learn little bits and pieces along the way. And like I say, our Aussie authors are just absolutely smashing it at the moment. And there's so much to learn from every single one of those people. So it would be, yeah, so that would be a piece of advice, is just have a look around. There's so many resources available. But one of the key things that I got from Sally Hepworth was this nifty 350 concept of, you know, you don't have to sit down and write a novel in one go. You actually just break it up bit by bit. And 350 words actually is quite achievable in a day. You know, it might be, some people might be super fast writers, other people it might take a little bit longer, and it doesn't have to be 350. It would be about the writers finding their own comfortable word count. But what it is it's a discipline about just getting it down and just saying, even at the end of the 350 words, if they're not perfect, that's fine. That's what the editing process is for. But it's about having that discipline just to keep moving forward. And that really helped me, because, you know, I understood that I couldn't have just sat down and written it in one go. It has to be done piece by piece. And sometimes you have to leave it for a minute and then come back to it. But it is just chipping away at it. bit by bit. So, yeah. And it's just reading as well. I mean, like I say, we're so spoiled at the moment. You don't even have to go offshore to be reading books. And every book that you read, you learn something from. You see different techniques. You learn about plotting and story and character development. And I think we've got such an abundance of teachers out there, and we can enjoy their stories along at the same time. So.
If listeners want to learn more about you and this book or future books, where can they find you?
There's some information on Affirm Press. So they're the publishers who have been good enough to me to publish this. And then I've also got an Instagram handle, which is rhianna.m.king. So yeah, it'd be great. It'd be great to connect with other authors and other listeners. Yeah.
There, that's wonderful. Rhianna, what an utter joy it has been to chat with you about this beautiful, charming, and thoroughly entertaining book. I wish you every success with it. And thank you so very much for joining me on Talking Aussie Books today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, and thank you so much for your support of me and other debut authors too. It's a huge privilege to be talking to you today, so thank you.
That's a wrap, folks. If you enjoyed this podcast episode, please drop me a line via my webpage at claudinetonellis.com, via Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter. Alternatively, consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Google Podcasts. Until next time, happy reading!